Hello, hello! Welcome to the second episode of the Global Trends and Diplomacy podcast. My name is Katarzyna Rybka-Iwańska, and I'm so glad that you are here with me. Thank you for all the reviews and all the feedback you gave after the first episode. I am grateful for the good vibes stemming from your congratulations, as well as for precise suggestions on what can be improved, like take it easy, no stress. I need to say that recording, producing, and airing the first episode was the best thing to do. Not only because done is better than perfect, but especially because you, people I care about, have acknowledged the quality of this podcast. This quality can grow only with practice, further experiments, and perseverance. Recording the second episode is difficult. It proved to be surprisingly harder than I imagined. I thought I should meet the expectations born with the debut and reach beyond them. I should create the wow effect once again. I should set the bar higher and higher. What a challenge, huh? I should. This is why it took me longer than I thought to record and air the second episode. I just wanted it too much, and I got stuck for some days. In the world of music, they call it the difficult second album syndrome. However, if there's one word to be remembered from the first episode, it's perseverance. Ultimately, I thought in the Richard Branson mode, screw it, let's do it. Let's persevere. Let's keep podcasting my way. My way meaning let's continue the warm-up and experiment with the formula. Let's try something slightly new and see what happens. The first episode was all about the female role models in the world of science. Today, I want to tell you a little bit more about why such role models matter. In this podcast, I want to discuss global trends. Women empowerment is one of them. The suffragette movement was born in the 19th century. The 20th century witnessed several waves of feminism, especially in the US and other Western countries. But it's the 21st century when the wave of women empowerment goes global and more resembles a tsunami. Women empowerment takes place all over the world, but its forms differ. In the most developed countries, women challenge the stereotypes and demand equal pay for equal work, a fair representation in the boards of Fortune 500 companies and Silicon Valley startups, as well as more female-focused stories filmed in Hollywood. In developed countries, women campaign also for an access to daycare for their children, for the maternity leave, for better regulations concerning alimonies and domestic violence. They challenge stereotypes about women's roles in societies and families. These are the places where sheroes like Sheryl Sandberg, Melinda Gates, and Anne-Marie Slaughter do their job. Sheryl Sandberg, a Silicon Valley business and technology tycoon, encourages women to lean in their workplaces and men to mentor promising, motivated, and talented women. Melinda Gates runs campaigns encouraging girls to engage in the STEM, science, technology, engineering, and mathematics sector. Anne-Marie Slaughter, in her book The Unfinished Business, and together with her husband, Andrew Morawczyk, campaigns for a better situation for caregivers, no matter their gender, in the American labor market. Reese Witherspoon sets up her own film production company and places an emphasis on women's stories in such productions as HBO's The Big Little Lies. Gina Davis runs a research and campaigning institute dealing with the issue of gender inequality in the broad film industry. These and other female role models in the US do a lot and set the tone of a broad international discussion. They have their counterparts in other developed countries. The challenges we face here are all important, but at the same time, in the least developed and developing countries, girls and women conduct an even more fundamental, fierce, and often horrific fight. They fight child marriage, female genital mutilation, a total or near total lack of access to healthcare, education, employment, and money. Let's look at some data. According to One, a global NGO and campaigner for girls and women's rights, there are 750 million girls and women alive today who were married before the age of 18. UNICEF estimates that more than 200 million girls and women in 30 countries of the world, where data is anyhow obtainable, have been victims of the female genital mutilation. According to USAID, 62 million girls worldwide are out of school. Two-thirds of the world's illiterate people are female. World Bank has counted that 79 economies have restrictions towards women's employment. In 18 economies, husbands can prevent their wives from going to work. The list of such statistics is way longer, but even these numbers speak for themselves. If they are somehow not enough, I propose to dig more into the situation in several countries. First, let's go to Pakistan. According to the Global Gender Gap Report of the World Economic Forum, Pakistan has the second worst situation of women in the world. There is only one field where Pakistan does not hit the bottom that much and obtains the 95th place out of 144 countries. That is, the political empowerment of women. The country seems to benefit from the heritage of late Benazir Bhutto, who was the Prime Minister of Pakistan twice in the 1980s and the 1990s. Benazir Bhutto's name is mentioned quite often recently in connection with Jacinda Ardern, New Zealand's Prime Minister, who has just given birth to a child while in office, as only the second head of government in the modern times in the world. Yes, after Benazir Bhutto. Coming back to Pakistan's data, being 95th in one field, and especially due to just one female leader, does not make the whole picture less bleak. The situation in the fields of economic participation and opportunity, health and survival, and especially education attainment in Pakistan remains bad. It is the country where 20% of world honor killings take place. 21% of Pakistani girls are married before the age of 18. Abductions of thousands of adolescent girls happen every year. This is why, according to UN Women, 40% of girls ages 6 to 10, 60% of girls ages 11 to 13, and as many as 80% of girls ages 14 to 15 are not enrolled to school. Only 46% of women are literate in Pakistan in comparison to some 70% of men. School life expectancy for girls equals only 7 years. The government spends just 2.5% of GDP on education, what places Pakistan on a low place, 164th in the world, according to the CIA World Factbook. The UN Women acknowledges institutional changes and programs that are introduced in Pakistan so that the situation of girls and women improves, but the progress remains slow. This is why the story of Pakistan's Malala Yousafzai is so important. It says much more than statistics. Malala often underlines that her story is not unique, but rather tragically typical to many girls, not only in Pakistan. This story explains many reasons why the access to education is a huge problem. Malala Yousafzai was born in Mingora, a middle-sized city in northern Pakistan, in 1997. Her parents, and especially her father, who worked as a teacher, wanted her to receive as good education as possible and strongly believed that it was possible. They were quite successful in it, but in 2007, the Taliban militants took the control over the region the Yousafzai family lived in. Malala started a blog about her life under the Taliban occupation and the restrictions to education she experienced. She soon became well-known internationally. The BBC produced a short movie about her and her father. Malala received Pakistan's first National Youth Peace Prize and was nominated for the International Children's Peace Prize. The Taliban militants didn't like it. One sunny day, they entered a school bus, asked who Malala was, and shot her in the head. The injuries were severe. Malala's condition was critical. The girl was transferred to the UK and survived thanks to British doctors. For the sake of her life, Malala stayed in the UK. Soon she became an even more famous and successful campaigner for the access to education for girls and boys around the world. Today, Malala is the youngest Nobel Peace Prize laureate, awarded in 2014 at the age of 17. She speaks before the United Nations, at Harvard University, the Canadian House of Commons, at the World Economic Forum, etc. She runs Malala Fund, under which, for instance, she opened a school for Syrian refugee schoolgirls in Lebanon and has conducted multiple projects in Pakistan, Nigeria, Kenya, Afghanistan and Jordan. Now she is just 21, studies at Oxford and continues her activist projects. Recently, she would come back to Pakistan for a few days, where she gave several public speeches with tears in her eyes, saying that if only could she would never leave Pakistan. Big bodyguards around her tiny body and a high level of security dedicated to her visit prove that there is still so much to do. The situation of women across the least developed and developing countries is challenging, to say the least. But women, not only in Pakistan, do as much as they can to improve their individual situations as well as the circumstances their communities live in. Malala is not the only example to prove this. Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, Leymah Bowie, both from Liberia, and Tawakkol Karman from Yemen are the laureates of the Nobel Peace Prize of 2011. They were acknowledged for their non-violent struggle for the safety of women and for women's rights to full participation in peace-building work. Today, let's have a closer look at Liberia. Leymah Bowie, with the organization she led, called Women of Liberia Mass Action for Peace, has heavily contributed to ending the second bloody civil war in Liberia in 2003. The organization conducted non-violent and silent protests. They put a pressure on the dictator, Charles Taylor, to attend peace talks and secured the peace agreement. The movement united over 3,000 Muslim and Christian women and helped Ellen Johnson Sirleaf become the first female president of an African country in 2006. Ellen Johnson Sirleaf served up until 2018. Before the presidency, she has had for years been engaged into politics as the finance minister and the senator. She also investigated the genocide in Rwanda as the representative designated by the Organization for African Unity. In 1997, Ellen Johnson Sirleaf took part in presidential election won by Charles Taylor, who started two bloody civil wars in his country. Today, long after the peace was brought, Liberia is clearly making progress in many fields. Life expectancy at birth is rising for men and women. The mortality rate of under 5 children is significantly falling, as well as the prevalence of HIV for two genders. Liberia is acknowledged in the Global Gender Gap Report for its performance in the political empowerment of women, due to, of course, the long leadership of Ellen Johnson Sirleaf. Unfortunately, the educational attainment is almost as weak as in Pakistan. 2.8% of GDP is spent on education. Only 33% of women are literate. This proves that women like Ellen Johnson Sirleaf and Leymah Bowie still have many things to do. There is a country in Africa that should certainly not be omitted in a podcast like this. The example of Rwanda proves that the change is possible, even in the least developed countries. Rwanda has reached the fourth position in the Global Gender Gap Report, straight below Iceland, Norway and Finland, and straight above Sweden. Rwanda is the global leader when it comes to health and survival of women. It obtains the third position in political empowerment, due to a growing number of females on ministerial positions and the biggest share of female parliamentarians in the world, over 60%. On average, there are just 20% of women in parliaments across the globe. Rwanda is seventh in the field of economic participation and opportunity. Almost 90% of Rwandan women work, and the pay gap is narrower than in many highly developed countries. But Rwandan women started to work in such big numbers also as parliamentarians and politicians, mostly due to the tragic heritage of the 1994 manslaughter that took place between Hutu and Tutsi. Straight after the horrific events, women were making around 70% of the population in Rwanda, and due to policies introduced by consecutive governments, their engagement into the labor market and political activism stayed on a high level. However, when it comes to educational attainment, Rwanda performs bad and obtains just 113th place. According to the World Economic Forum, only 20% of Rwandans have access to electricity and they live on average almost 20 years shorter than Swedes. Rwandan women and men again have to continue to work hard to get their country out of poverty. For now, they are successful in securing peace. a big deal for a country where almost 1 million people were slaughtered in just 3 months in 1994. I will never forget listening to Valentine Rugwabiza, then Rwanda's Minister for East African Community and now Rwanda's permanent representative to the United Nations. I saw her in 2015 at the India-Africa Summit and the Asian Forum on Global Governance I took part in. When I asked her about the Rwandan women engagement in politics, her passion has just filled the conference room. I wanted to record a podcast full of good news. In fact, after a very inspirational first episode, this time you may feel a little bit blue. As an analyst, however, I just can't paint a colorful slash rainbow picture when UN Women, the World Economic Forum, the International Committee of the Red Cross, and many other institutions, as well as world leaders, alarm that the situation of girls and women around the world is bad and often even worsening. However, there is a saying that maybe the pessimists are right, but these are optimists who change the world. This is why all the statistics here are juxtaposed with the inspirational stories of Malala Yousafzai, Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, Leymah Bowie, and Valentine Rugwabiza. They are certainly optimists who never give up. Thank you for listening to the second episode of the Global Trends and Diplomacy podcast. Please let me know what you think of it. Is it useful? Is it interesting? Does my podcast make you stop for a moment and reflect on its contents? Are you waiting for further episodes? I am truly looking forward to learning what you think. Let's keep in touch and stay tuned for further episodes. Bye-bye!